Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit the webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the milk of human kindness is not pasteurized right after this. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. John Swinton made this observation. He was the guest of honor at the banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor Swinton offered a toast to the independent press, and Swinton totally outraged his colleagues when he replied that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. You know it, and I know it. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write honest opinions would be out in the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. You know it, and I know it. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. You know it, and I know it. And what folly is this toasting an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents are possibilities and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and the New World Order, the men and families like the Windsors, the Rockefellers, Bushes, Bundys, Carnegies, and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians, and let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000 and the New World Order, along with Bible prophecy, why don't you call and order my four-hour compact disc package? It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? A fellow by the name of William Campbell Douglas wrote a book called The Milk of Human Kindness is Not Pasteurized. Sounds almost blasphemous. Milk that's unpasteurized? Where would civilization be today without pasteurized and homogenized milk? Well, I'll tell you, we'd all be dead. Well, at least that's the story that we get out of the public education system. Now, somehow or another, people lived for about 4,000 or 5,000 years drinking raw milk. And, of course, it killed everybody. And that's why there are no humans left on planet Earth, because milk killed them. And the salvation of mankind was pasteurization and homogenization, which came around to about 1900. And without that, if we were all dead drinking raw milk by 1900, then how did pasteurized milk save us? Well, he wrote a book called The Milk of Human Kindness is Not Pasteurized, and in the Bible we read of the land of milk and honey. Now, how can this be? A land of milk and honey? Well, did Moses instruct us on pasteurization so that mankind wouldn't annihilate himself with unpasteurized milk or raw milk? Well, let's take a look at the history of milk. You know, one of the most revolutionary developments in human history was the invention of milking animals for food by the ancients of southwestern Asia. It's hard to understand why no one else thought of it, at least for hundreds of years. South American Indians had an ample supply of milk available in the llama, but they never took advantage of it. North American Indians had buffalo, but buffaloes are not easily milked. The Chinese and Japanese are pretty smart people, but they never thought of milking animals and drinking milk. Milking was introduced there only within the last century. The goat was probably the first animal to have the honor of being milked. Horses are too big, dogs too small, cats won't put up with it. But domesticated horses now produce great quantities of milk around the world. Better than cows, they tell me. The earliest pictures of milking show the milker sitting directly behind the cow. Not a very smart idea. Man learns everything the hard way. As milking caught on, the technique was extended to almost all domesticated animals except pigs. The revolutionary adoption of milking domesticated animals for human food enormously increased man's protein supply, and milk with grain became the standard diet of most of the Western world. Well, until very recently, the peasants of Scotland ate very little else. Dr. Samuel Johnson made the comment that oats are food for horses in England and food for men in Scotland, to which the Scots replied, "And where else will you find such horses and such men?" Well, when the English came to Johnstown, or Jamestown rather, in 1611, they brought their cows with them. Now, you can imagine the astonishment of the Indians on first encountering these strange, docile, short-haired buffalo. With the milk that they brought with them, they brought tuberculosis, brucellosis, undulant fever, typhoid, and other diseases that the Indians didn't need and shouldn't have had. But don't misunderstand me, it wasn't the fault of the milk, it was diseased people who contaminated the milk that caused the problem. Now, during the Renaissance period, the farmers painted their cows yellow to stimulate milk production, and cows and their cousins, such as the ox, have played a very important role throughout history. And if you're really interested in the cow's point of view on history, religion, and the arts, you need to read The Cow Book by Mark Gallant. The Cow Book, Mark, M-A-R-C, Gallant, published by Alfred A. Knopt, New York, 1983. Milk remained an honest product for over 200 years. Sure, it was contaminated, but so was everything else. Then the first milk manipulators came along. A guy by the name of Gale Borden, you probably heard the name Borden milk. He discovered by condensing milk, Borden discovered that it would keep for longer periods due to its high sugar content. The first attempt at extending shelf life of a very short-lived product called milk, and he patented the process, and it's been downhill for milk ever since. But the original culprit was probably the Italian biologist Lazzaro Spallangeni, who popularized the preserving of food through heating back in 1765. 1873 was another fateful year for milk, especially here in the United States. Dr. Abraham Jacoby publicly urged the boiling or cooking of all milk used in infant feeding because of the frightful carnage of babies at that time from infectious diseases. At times, the death toll reached the unbelievable figure of 65%, and the annual loss of babies throughout the country, largely due to unsanitary conditions, with consequent fatal infections, exceeded a quarter of a million a year. That was here in America. A quarter of a million babies a year dying from infectious diseases. Now, cows in the late 1800s were fed on garbage, or at least a lot of them were. The commissioner of the New York State Health Department, Dr. Herman E. Hellebo, reported that cows were milked in a mixture of manure and mud, dust, dirt, filth, and disease. Germs were as much the total product that people drank as was the milk itself. And on farms, pails that were used to carry slop to the pigs were also used to convey milk to human consumers. The New York philanthropist Nathan Strauss lost a child from contaminated milk. Diphtheria was the diagnosis. This prompted him to start his famous milk stations, where only cooked or pasteurized milk was supplied to the poor of the city. Now, the effectiveness of heat-treated milk in reducing mortality in the late 19th and early 20th century is indisputable. In a seven-year period, starting in 1897, the death rate among children in New York City dropped from 42% to 22%, and the only discernible change was the pasteurization or the heat treatment of the milk. The first successful tuberculin test for dairy herds began in 1890. In 1893, under the direction of Dr. Henry L. Coit of Newark, New Jersey, there began a serious effort to control the cleanliness of milk, and Dr. Coit deserves some sort of medal for his pioneer work in cleaning up the milk supply. The certification process was started in Essex County, New Jersey, rapidly spreading around the country, and in 1907, the certification of milk, that is, the ensuring by a group of concerned physicians that the milk was pure enough to drink, was generally a standard. Pasteurization began back in 1895, and thus began the unfortunate habit of not worrying about cleanliness in the dairy, because with the heating of the milk, cleanliness was no longer considered necessary. The bacteria in the milk would simply be boiled, killing the germs, and then the milk could be sold in this adulterated form. It has been sold that way ever since, and because of pasteurization, tuberculosis was not completely eliminated from cows in the United States until 1941. Now, if the United States Public Health Service and the American Medical Association had done the responsible thing and backed the various medical milk commissions' efforts to keep milk clean, tuberculosis could have been eliminated from American cows many decades sooner. Well, Dr. Henry Coit, the father of certified milk, recognized clearly that top-quality milk depended upon getting the fresh milk from the cow and not heating it, as is done in the pasteurization process. He was an advocate of whole, raw milk, and he recognized that the best way to present the best and most nutritious product to the public was to deliver milk as made by nature from a completely clean environment. So the decision was to be made between clean milk or pasteurized milk. Pasteurized dirty milk won out. In 1891, Coit received an even stronger impetus to crusade for clean milk. His first son, only 2 years old, died from contaminated milk, and it took 6 years for Dr. Coit to talk the first dairyman, Stephen Francisco, into producing certified milk. Now, this term, certified, meant that the milk was inspected by a board of physicians and was certified by them to meet rigid standards of cleanliness. By 1904, 13 years after the tragic death of Coit's son, certified dairies were being inspected regularly. But these progressive dairies represented only a tiny percentage of milk production in the United States, and the battle for disease-free milk was only beginning. It was estimated in 1905 that 35% of the 24 million dairy cattle had tuberculosis and over 10% had brucellosis. Today's raw certified milk must not have a germ count higher than 10,000 per cubic centimeter. In 1911, the milk being served in hospitals often had a count as high as 20 million germs per cubic centimeter. The Medical Milk Commission, the group of physicians that inspected and certified the raw milk as meeting the rigid standards of safety, grew rapidly all across the United States, and by 1930, clean, unpasteurized raw milk was generally available across the country. Now, if this healthy trend had continued, pasteurized milk would have never been accepted by the American public. Certification of raw milk by medical experts was rapidly eliminating the disease problem from milk. They had proven that tampering with milk by heat treatment, pasteurization, was totally unnecessary, improbably unhealthy, and dangerous. The people did not trust pasteurization for many reasons, the main one being the nutrition factor. Hall and Trout, in their book Milk Pasteurization, admit that due to the deep-seated distrust of pasteurization, one is astounded that the process ever was successfully introduced. But the pasteurization fanatics were determined to eliminate raw milk from the dinner table. They had accepted pasteurization as a veritable religion, and although the Medical Milk Commission had proven beyond a doubt that clean milk, not heated milk, but clean milk, was the answer to the problem, they proved and they moved forward with a relentless propaganda blitz. The devious war fought against raw certified milk will be discussed in detail later. Human milk also has a long and interesting history. In Sparta, in 400 BC, it was decreed that mothers must breastfeed all babies. The Koran dictates that mothers shall suckle their children for 2 years. Caesar ridiculed the mothers of Rome who retained wet nurses for their children. Early American Indians believed that the longer a child received breast milk, the longer it would live. It was not uncommon for Indian babies to be suckled until the age of 9 years. Now, a half century ago, Eskimos were known to nurse their babies for up to 15 years. In the 18th century, there was a great faith in the healing and preventive aspects of human milk. Finland went so far as to penalize a non-nursing mother whose child died during the first 6 months of life. In Chapter 9, you'll see why that wasn't such a bad idea. The vogue-conscious French almost destroyed their own race in the 18th century when bottle feeding became stylish. A French physician at the time said ladies of quality did not breastfeed so they could have more time to dress, receive, and pay visits, attend public shows, and spend the night at their beloved cards. Now, the history of milk is the history of civilization. Without it, there would be no civilization. Now, this is going to be an important chapter. It's the heart of the book, and we'll divide it into part one and part two. It's called Utter Destruction, spelled U-D-D-E-R. Now, a friend of mine in Florida was talking to the wife of a dairyman at a party, and my friend, conscious of the myriad of problems associated with pasteurized and homogenized milk, asked this wife of the dairyman if their dairy would supply her family with raw milk. Well, the dairyman's wife blanched white and stiffened. Certainly not. We would never touch the stuff. The dairyman's wife was offended, and she was embarrassed that such a question would be asked in polite society. Now, when someone that close to milk production has such an emotional and deep-rooted prejudice against fresh, unpasteurized raw milk, the pasteurizers, along with most public health departments and doctors, have indeed convinced the people of America, and probably worldwide, that heat-treated milk, called pasteurization, is as essential as fluoridation of the water supply. But, as with fluoridation, not everybody is convinced, and a small band of determined and dedicated dairy farmers and nutritionists continue to work for the return of fresh, raw, untreated milk. Initially, the motivation for pasteurization was anything but altruistic. You see, unscrupulous dairymen knew that if they heated the milk, it wouldn't sour. Sour milk is a harmless but often gastronomically undesirable state for milk. Heat treatment enabled them to avoid expensive sanitary procedures and to deliver the milk to unsuspecting consumers, apparently fresh. Now, the milk was anything but fresh. The milk was dead. It was dead because, having killed most of the enzymes and altered the protein and fat through heat treatment, the milk didn't sour. Pasteurized milk doesn't sour, it rots, like any dead animal tissue will. However, the dead milk was usually drunk before the rotting process took place, so no one was the wiser. In spite of modern techniques of pasteurization, pasteurized milk is still dead milk, which will rot upon standing. People knowledgeable in dairy science at the turn of the century were opposed to heat treatment of milk. They realized that one of nature's perfect foods was being altered from a natural food to a processed, industrial, unnatural food. And during this period, called the Dark Era by pasteurization zealots, consciousness or conscientious nutritionists and dairy experts strongly opposed pasteurization, realizing that commercial interests were only concerned about shelf life. They were not concerned about nutritious, unadulterated milk. Cholera infantum was a dreaded disease of children in the early 20th century. 5,000 babies died annually from the summer diarrhea, and it was found to be caused by milk contaminated by an excessive number of ordinary dirt bacteria. It was reported by Dr. Park of the New York Health or City Health Department. It was just plain dirty milk. But instead of requiring the dairies to clean up their act and produce clean milk, they instead turned to heat treatment of the dirty milk to kill the bacteria. That way, they eradicated the dreaded cholera infantum. But they paid a terrible price. You see, a steady increase in crib death, infantile allergy, colitis, heart disease, stroke, and sexual impotency are the side effects of pasteurized milk, just to name a few. As a temporary expedient, while the technologies of sanitation engineering and refrigeration were being developed, heat treatment pasteurization was better than nothing. And although the milk was inferior and would cause degenerative diseases later in life, at least it wouldn't kill the babies and the small children in their early childhood. But the milk producers were clinging to outdated methods. In an age of sophisticated sanitation, where even horse liniment and toilet paper are made under remarkably clean conditions, the milk industry leans heavily on heat treatment of milk and milk products to cover up sloppy production methods and just plain production of dirty product or dirty milk. Now, this is sanitation at the wrong end. The dairymen continued to look backward toward Pasteur and Spallanzini rather than forward toward Coit, Mathis, and Staub. They continued to destroy the food value of milk for economic expediency when technologically it is no longer necessary. We can produce clean raw milk. Initially, the dairy industry itself also fought the compulsory heating of milk. No one likes to change the system. That costs money. And finally, losing in court, the dairymen caved in and joined the pasteurization movement. Today, locked into the heat pasteurization system, they will fight equally hard to avoid moving forward to fresh, unheated milk production. The industry continues to protect us against disease conditions of 100 years ago, and in the process, they destroy the value of the product that they're trying to sell. In the book Milk Pasteurization, Hall and Trout say perhaps no other single innovation has made such an impact on a food industry as the heat treatment of milk. Within the span of 100 years, the milk industry evolved from almost total obscurity to the giant of the food industry. The flowering of the milk industry was made possible by the parboiling or pasteurization, as it is now called, of milk. This parboiling or heating of milk had no effect on the incidence of tuberculosis caused by milk. And that's because you can actually drink milk from a tubercular cow with impunity. The blood membrane barrier prevents the tubercular bacteria from passing into the milk. It was tuberculosis milkers who infected the milk by coughing into it, not the tubercular cows. Now, the incidence of brucellosis, or undulant fever, contrary to popular opinion, was really not affected by the pasteurization process. Brucellosis is not contracted through milk. It's contracted by association directly with animals. The farmer or other adult milking the cow would often get brucellosis, but his children who drank most of the milk seldom got the disease. This so-called pasteurization process is far from new and was done long before Pasteur. In 1782, the Swedish scientist Scheele heat-treated or pasteurized it to preserve vinegar. In fact, the earliest recorded incidence of the pasteurization process was actually in 1765 by Spallanzini, who preserved meat through the heat treatment process. In 1824, a professor of obstetrics at the University of Pennsylvania, his name was William Deweese, recommended heating milk to the boiling point, then cooling it for infant feeding. He said, in hot weather, it is true, the tendency to decomposition is diminished by boiling the milk. But as all the advantages which may result in the process can be procured without its being absolutely boiled, it should never be had recourse to. Now, although Pasteur was given the credit for the parboiling method, and it takes its name of pasteurization from Pasteur, the record does not show that Louis Pasteur ever pasteurized any milk. Pasteur succeeded in developing a system of heat application to control fermentation, and thus the preservation of wine. The wine industry was greatly benefited, as it had discovered the method of preventing wine from spoiling. He also succeeded in applying this principle to the preservation of beer. Pasteur does indeed deserve credit, as the basic method applied to milk is the same as that for beer. Now, a German by the name of Soxhalt, about 20 years after Pasteur's discovery, applied Pasteur's method to the pasteurization of milk for infant feeding. The process was introduced in the United States about 1889. Nathan Strauss, a wealthy New York philanthropist, was appalled at the mortality of children being fed raw milk. So he established milk depots in the city of New York which offered heat-treated milk to children. The death rate from raw milk fell dramatically in New York as a result of Strauss's effort. Strauss spread the gospel around the United States, in fact, the entire free world, and he was the single most influential man in making pasteurization a universally used and recognized procedure. Hall and Trout, in their book Milk Pasteurization, are extremely laudatory of the pasteurization process. They obviously believe that pasteurization is one of the greatest boons ever to come to mankind. Now, the authors list former objections to pasteurization of milk and clearly imply that none of these objections are currently valid. We will list some of these former objections and make some comment on them. Pasteurization is an excuse for the sale of dirty milk. Pasteurization may be used to mask low-quality milk, and pasteurization promotes carelessness, and it discourages the effort to produce clean milk. Compulsory pasteurization would diminish the incentive to clean up milk production. Heat destroys a great number of bacteria in milk and thus conceals the evidence of dirt. Pasteurization impairs the flavor of milk. Pasteurization diminishes the nutrient value of milk. The milk is devitalized. Pasteurization diminishes vitamin content. Pasteurization destroys vitamin C. Calcium and other minerals are precipitated and made unavailable by pasteurization. Milk enzymes are destroyed. Infants do not develop well on pasteurized milk. Children and infants thrive better on raw milk. Pasteurized milk is more likely to lead to decay in teeth. Pasteurized milk is more likely to be constipating. Pasteurization destroys the creaming ability of milk. Pasteurization influences the composition of milk. Pasteurization destroys the souring bacteria of milk, so that milk, instead of souring normally, will putrefy if kept long enough. Pasteurization kills the bacilli in milk and causes it to decompose when exposed to air. Pasteurization destroys beneficial enzymes. antibodies, and hormones, which take the life out of milk. Pasteurization may be carelessly done, therefore it is not infallible. Pasteurized milk may diminish resistance to disease, especially in young babies. The death from tuberculosis remains uniformly lower in rural areas where such milk is drunk raw than in cities where the milk is pasteurized. Compulsory pasteurization would remove the stimulus to eradicate diseased animals from the milking herds. Pasteurized milk interferes with the proper development of the teeth and predisposes to dental caries. Pasteurization would lead to an increase in infant mortality, and pasteurization gives a false sense of security. And there are many others, and we will not waste time listing here, but the interesting and important point here is that all of these former objections to pasteurized milk are just as true today as they were when they were listed by Hall and Trout 15 years ago. And Hall and Trout go on in glowing terms to tell us how three generations have thrived on pasteurized milk and enjoy radiant health. But they also admit, with so many beliefs unfavorable to the pasteurization of milk, one is astounded that the process was ever introduced. And the final acceptance of pasteurization by the consumer is little short of phenomenal, especially in light of the fact that when cats are fed pasteurized milk in four generations, they become sterile. I wonder if sterility in humans has anything to do with pasteurized milk. Well, hang on. We got to take a break here at the halfway point and give you a couple of reminders. One is that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, just go to the website georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call the law school at 417-273-4967. All right, tonight we're reviewing the book, The Milk of Human Kindness Is Not Pasteurized, by William Campbell Douglas. You can probably get a copy of this milk, or this book rather. It's published by Last Laugh Publishers, 2550 Windy Hill Road, Suite 315, Marietta, Georgia 30067. Again, that's Last Laugh Publishers, 2550 Windy Hill Road, Suite 315, Marietta, Georgia 30067. Copyright 1985 by William Campbell Douglas. All rights reserved. Printed in the United States of America by Copple House Books Incorporated, Lakemont, Georgia 30552. You might try Copple House Books Incorporated, Lakemont, Georgia 30552. Or just go to your local used bookstore and tell them you're looking for a copy of The Milk of Human Kindness Is Not Pasteurized, by William Campbell Douglas. Well, the state of Massachusetts, back in 1908, recognizing that pasteurized milk was no longer a vital food, passed a law that required milk subjected to heating to be labeled heated milk in 1-inch black letters against a white background. By about 1950, raw certified milk became essentially non-existent in this country, except in three states. The public was thoroughly convinced through massive advertising over the years that their original suspicions about pasteurized milk were unfounded, and that the pasteurization process was protecting them from rampant disease conditions. Hall and Trout eulogized this condition. They said pasteurization of milk has attained a near perfection within a half century. Perhaps the greatest achievement lies in the acclaim of people of many nations for pasteurized household milk. And although Hall and Trout are extremely laudatory, in fact wildly enthusiastic about the merits of the pasteurization of milk, they make some interesting comments when comparing the keeping quality of the two types of milk. They say that the influence on the keeping quality after pasteurization is often exaggerated. The chief organisms responsible for spoilage of pasteurized milk originate from pasteurization contamination. Pasteurization contamination. And they go on to quote other authors who concluded that the number of bacteria found in the milk give absolutely no indication of how well pasteurized milk would keep. As mentioned, the bacteria responsible for spoilage later are not the same ones found in raw milk. Raw milk doesn't have those bacteria. The author stated apologetically, quote, "The effect of heat for minimum pasteurization intensity has generally little significance except, of course, in the destruction of certain bacteria and enzymes. These certain bacteria and enzymes are absolutely vital to the production of nutritious and safe milk." They then go on to admit that because of the complexity of milk fat, and we don't really know how much change takes place due to the pasteurization process. They go on to say that milk fat may be involved in many of the unknown effects of heat. Data bearing on the speculative effects of heat on the fat itself are secretly existent, or scarcely existent. The protein casein is also affected by pasteurization. The effects of this on the human body are not or are unknown at this time. They also report that the chief serum proteins of milk, that is, lactalbumin and lactoglobulin, are both adversely affected by high heat treatment of milk. And although the authors admit to the deficiencies of certain vitamins and minerals found in pasteurized milk, they turn to other authorities to reassure us that the changes are negligible. Don't worry about it. And they quote K. et al., the original suggestion that pasteurization seriously diminished the nutritive value of milk has been proved conclusively to be ill-founded, they say. Unquote. Now, enzymes are still little understood as far as their contribution to human nutrition is concerned, but undoubtedly they play a very important part. And the authors make little of enzymes, and they report that a large number of enzymes are completely destroyed in the process of pasteurization. Now, they attribute little importance to this, and they point out that the complete destruction of the enzyme phosphatase is one method of testing to see if the milk has been adequately pasteurized. Phosphatase is essential for the absorption of calcium, but the complete destruction of phosphatase is the aim of pasteurization. I got to stop and make a little editorial comment here. You know, one of the main claims of milk is that it contains all of this calcium, and that if you want to get more and more calcium, you want to drink more and more milk, because milk has a very high concentration of calcium. And the advertisers on Madison Avenue who are advertising calcium in milk are not lying to us. They are telling us the truth. That when you drink milk, you are drinking lots and lots of calcium. That's true. What they're not telling you is that when you heat treat milk, you destroy the enzyme that is required for the digestion process so that your body can assimilate the calcium. So the net effect is this. You buy milk because you want to get the calcium. And indeed, you get it. But you can't digest it. So it doesn't make any difference whether you drink milk or not. If it's pasteurized, the calcium is unavailable to your body. So why in the world would you want to buy milk for calcium when there's no enzyme in it to digest it and you can't assimilate it? In only America would we use this kind of circular logic. Well, I drink milk because it's filled with calcium. And yes, I know that my body cannot assimilate the calcium because the enzyme has been destroyed by the pasteurization process, but that's why I drink milk, so that I can get more calcium. I think it's part of the dumbing down process. We go to public schools and then we get letters after our names, and then we can't think any longer. Well, the calcium, or the chemistry of calcium in human nutrition, is much better understood today than when the phosphatase test was introduced. The decalcification of milk, which is fed to children, may be a major cause of osteoporosis later in life. Osteoporosis is a thinning of the bones, especially in older women, which leads to fractures, great pain, and then premature death. Now, other factors which contribute to the literal dissolving of the skeleton are the high phosphates in cola drinks and many food diets, such as the Scarsdale diet, which is notoriously low in calcium. And the high protein diets also accelerate calcium excretion. We now know that low calcium absorption in healthy women may cause a loss of spinal bone mass as early as age 20. And such women may lose 50% or more of their bone mass by the age of 70. Now, when you add other calcium-wasting problems, such as vitamin D and C deficiency, alcoholism, antacids, anticoagulants, anticonvulsants, barbiturates, cortisone, diuretics, and smoking, it's no wonder Grandma is falling on her face from a fractured hip. If you would give Grandma at least a pint of raw milk every day, she will probably never have a fractured hip, and she won't waste away either. The enzyme lapse is also totally destroyed by the pasteurization process. Lipase aids in the digestion of fats. Homogenization, the pulverization of milk fat, causes more lipase to be released into the milk. So Hall and Trout tell us, the complete destruction of lipase is imperative, otherwise the milk becomes rancid. No lipase for fat digestion, no phosphates for calcium absorption, no galactase for milk sugar digestion, no catalase, dietes, or peroxides, but the authors conclude the healthfulness of people enjoying high per capita consumption of pasteurized milk attests to the maintenance of its nutritive value. I got to pause here and make an observation. Since 1970, the consumption of milk in America has decreased by 30%, or about 1% a year. It's not uncommon for people to be lactose intolerant. And in order for some people to digest milk, they have to go to the drugstore to get a digestive enzyme, then take the enzyme in order to digest the milk. The milk that had the enzyme in it before you pasteurized it, remember? Now here's the circular reasoning. I don't drink milk because I'm lactose intolerant. But I can go to the drugstore and get a digestive enzyme, and then I can drink milk, because the digestive enzyme replaces the enzyme that was killed or destroyed in the pasteurization process. That's why I drink milk with an enzyme from the drugstore. And again, we have letters after our names, and we go to public schools, and we learn this kind of crap, and then we call ourselves educated, don't we? Now, Hall and Trout tell us that the vitamin C content of milk can play an important role in human nutrition. They're referring to pasteurized milk, of course. They claim that a quart of pasteurized milk contains 16 milligrams of vitamin C, one-fourth of the official requirement. However, something they did not know at the time was the effect that fluorescent light has on milk. Milk in almost all grocery stores is placed in open bins with fluorescent lighting. This fluorescent lighting has been shown to destroy half of the vitamin C content of the milk. This loss, along with the pasteurization loss, does not make pasteurized milk a good source of vitamin C. All right, got to pause here for another editorial comment. Vitamin C is an important nutrient. You can get 25% of your vitamin C in raw milk in one glass. Four glasses, one quart, would give you the amount of vitamin C that you need in one day. But if you put this milk under fluorescent light, the fluorescent light will destroy the vitamin C. The pasteurization will destroy the vitamin C. Now, let's see. We pasteurize the milk. It destroys the enzymes, which destroys the ability of you to utilize the calcium. We put it under fluorescent light and pasteurize it to destroy the vitamin C. Now, boys and girls, isn't the point, isn't the purpose of eating food to gain nutrients? Isn't food the fuel that your body utilizes to build strong bones, strong teeth, healthy body? I mean, you know, if you didn't eat for the nutritional value, doesn't that tell you then that disease will result? And isn't it a fact that when you have vitamin C deficiency, you develop scurvy? When you have a vitamin D deficiency, you develop rickets. And to cure rickets and scurvy, don't you give vitamin D and vitamin C? Well, then doesn't that tell us then that food is for the purpose of nourishing your body to eliminate symptoms which are called disease? So isn't the purpose for drinking milk to eliminate disease? And if we don't drink healthy, nutritious milk, that we will become diseased? Again, we go to our public educational institutions. We get letters after our names. But somehow or another, we're unable to put a connecting link together with disease and nutrition. Doctors never put health nor healthy food or the lack of it, rather, as a cause of disease. They tell you, eat whatever you want. And if you develop a symptom, come in here, we'll give you a pill, we'll give you a shot, we'll give you some kind of a therapy over here to take the pain away. My common sense says to me, we'd be better off if we ate healthy, nutritious food and didn't develop the symptoms, didn't get the diseases to start with. What do you think? Well, back in the late 1930s, the system of clarification was added to the milk processing business. Now, the clarifier is used basically to clean up debris, manure, pus, and other foreign material that is in the milk as a result of sloppy manufacturing methods. Hull and Trout state that the centrifugal clarification of milk was early frowned upon by officials who suspected the process would be used to clean up dirty milk. But they say research showed that clarification was necessary to prevent the sedimentation found even in aseptically produced milk, which was the result of settling out of leucocytes. Is that right? Leukocytes. I guess that's leukocytes in milk, which had been homogenized. Now, the average reader would not know what leukocytes are, so we're going to tell you. Leukocytes are called pus in everyday language. Pus. That's right, just plain pus. With the onset of homogenization, a very undesirable situation had developed. You see, the leukocytes, that is the pus, were now noted to settle to the bottom of the bottle and make a grayish oil-like sludge. Now, you cannot sell milk with a pus layer on the bottom. And as almost all milk is now homogenized, something had to be done to get this pus out. So the clarification process was instituted. The sediment removed by the clarification process is called in the milk trade slime. And that's exactly what it is. Slime. A process called vacuration removes undesirable odors from dirty milk. That's why those in the business call the vacuator a fart snatcher. It's called the fart snatcher. It's what you put milk through. Now, let's see. We've devitalized the milk by pasteurization. Then we homogenize the milk. Then we have to clarify the milk. Now, we've got flavor enhancers that we have to put into the milk. Because, you see, when a cow eats onions, the onion flavor of the onion goes through to the milk. Well, you people aren't going to drink onion-tasting milk. In fact, milk is like honey. Bees produce alfalfa honey, clover honey, eucalyptus honey, orange honey. The taste of the honey is influenced by what it is that the bees are eating. What are the bees making this honey out of? If they're making it out of orange blossoms, then they get what's called orange blossom honey. If they're making it out of eucalyptus, then it's eucalyptus honey. If the bees are working in a clover field, it's called clover honey and so on. I mean, you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure that out. Now, milk is the same. But you see, if you were to drink milk, and one day you bought milk and it tasted like onion, the next day it tasted like dock, and the next day it tasted like something else, you wouldn't like that very well, because people develop tastes, you know. And so you'd have to have milk that was orange milk, or you'd have to have chocolate milk, or you'd have to have some other flavored milk. And the dairy industry, they don't want to label their milk like beekeepers have to label their honey. That's more expense, and that's a problem. So what they do is they tell the dairyman, if you've got onions out there in your fields, you get rid of the onions. You spray those with some kind of a chemical. Never mind that the cow is going to eat the grass that this chemical is on, and that chemical is going to come through the milk. That's all right. We don't care about that. But we're real concerned about this flavor, because we want to sell this stuff. Now, you need to understand, boys and girls, that when you drink raw milk that comes off of natural pasture, like my cows here, they go down into the woods, and a cow will balance her diet. You see, the only milk that the calf is going to get, the only nutrition this calf is going to get, is from this cow's milk. And that cow is designed by God to go down into the woods, and she'll eat dock, she'll eat oak leaves, she'll eat acorn, she'll eat any kind of weed, any kind of plant that has that nutrient in it, she'll eat it. When you drink raw cow's milk on natural pasture, you will get all the vitamins and minerals that God intended you to have in a land of milk and honey. You can't miss. Now, of course, the cows that you are drinking your milk from the Kroger store only get alfalfa, clover, and grass. They don't get any natural pasture. They don't get any oak leaves or dock or onion or anything else out there. Their diets are restricted. And that's why dairy cows are so unhealthy. And that's why they only last 5 or 6 years. I've got cows here that are 20 years old and still milking and still calving every year. Why, in a dairy herd, a cow that's 6 years old is ancient. Dairy cows should last for 20 years. And they should be healthy all the time. Anytime you got a sick cow, you've got a cow that isn't getting proper nutrition. And if the cow doesn't get proper nutrition, the milk doesn't have the nutrients in it either. So now let's see. We're drinking. Even if the cow had nutritious milk when you milked her, by the time we get through pasteurizing and homogenizing and clarifying and then flavor enhancing the milk, you have an industrial process like gasoline. And that's what we're producing in our dairies. Not the dairy farm, no. The guy at the dairy farm, he's just producing a raw product. Just like the guy with an oil well, he just produces a raw product. That raw product is taken to a refinery and is turned into its various component parts. That's why you can go to the grocery store and buy sour cream, or whipping cream, or half and half, or 1%, 2%, or whole milk, or pasteurized milk, or raw milk, or there's still a couple of three states where you can buy raw milk. Not many, but there's a few. Now, raw certified milk should be kept 4 to 5 days with absolutely no damage to the public, because it's clean when milked. But it's delivered in less than 24 hours from milking to the consumer. Now, I want to make one more observation here. Do you know what the shelf life of raw milk is? 5 days. 5 days. Do you know what the shelf life of pasteurized milk is? 14 days. They've got a process now called ultra-pasteurization. Do you know what the shelf life of ultra-pasteurized milk is? I think you could lock it up in a time capsule and open the time capsule in 100 years and drink it, and it wouldn't be sour, wouldn't rot, because there's no bacteria left in it. Now, you see, all milk has bacteria, and the bacteria in the milk, as it multiplies, you see, every 20 seconds, bacteria multiply at room temperature. That's why you refrigerate milk, because it retards the reproduction of the bacteria in the milk. So over time, if you put milk out on the kitchen table at 70 degrees, it'll spoil, it'll go sour on you if it's raw milk, in about 24 hours, 48 hours max. If you put milk, raw milk, into the refrigerator at 35 to 40 degrees, it'll keep 5 to 7 days. And every day, the bacteria count grows, and every day the flavor of the milk changes. Raw milk, the flavor of raw milk changes every day. Raw milk is influenced by what the cow eats. Natural raw milk, designed the way God made milk, has a different taste, just like honey. Now, once you get used to eating or drinking pasteurized, homogenized milk, it has a uniform flavor that remains the same from California to New York, because the manufacturing process is the same as when you buy gasoline in California or you buy gasoline in New York. It works in your car in either state. Now, there are some minor differences in the manufacturing processes of various creamers, but they're very minor. It's an industrial product. It's a manufactured product. And it's a product that you want to be uniform in every state in the union. And indeed, pasteurized, homogenized milk is. But it's not food, and it should not be sold in grocery stores. It should be sold in gas stations as an industrial product, just like gasoline and motor oil. In one investigation detailing the heat treatment of milk, it was revealed that not just one simple heating takes place. Milk is heated over again with each process. In clarification, the milk may be heated to 135 degrees Fahrenheit. In the filtering process, the milk is heated again to about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. In the bacteriofugation process, method of removing bacteria, the milk is again heated to 170 degrees Fahrenheit. With deaeration, a vacuum treatment is used in which the milk is treated in two vacuum chambers, the first at 175 degrees Fahrenheit, the second at 100 degrees to 152 degrees Fahrenheit. These heats may vary according to the system used. But the milk is heated over and over again. It's hard to imagine this milk resembling the original product after all of this steam cleaning. And that's because it isn't milk any longer. It's an industrial product. You ought to understand that. It's an industrial product. All right, we're about out of time. I'm going to have to leave it here. We'll take it up right here again tomorrow when we talk about milk. The milk of human kindness is not pasteurized. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school and ask 417-273-4967. Again, that's 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.